The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, we had just started discussing Matthew, and I picked Matthew in particular because it has been kind of a Matthew 5 stronghold of theonomic argument, and also because we really need to reflect in somewhat more detail on the way in which the law comes to bear on us as it's fulfilled in the New Testament period. So I'd begun then with looking at Matthew, not only Matthew 5, 17 to 20, but the background of that passage, and arguing that Matthew has a very rich conception of fulfillment, which he's building up, even at the first few verses, as a matter of fact, with the genealogy of the kings structured leading forward to Christ. And then he goes on with many incidents which are reminiscent of the experiences of Israel and of Moses as the representative of Israel in the Old Testament period. So the first section of his gospel, picks up very deeply and broadly on the idea of the fulfillment of the five books of Moses. And in connection with that, then, the Sermon on the Mount is a fulfillment of the Mount Sinai and the giving of the law with its blessings and curses, and Jesus begins appropriately then with a series of blessings. Against that background, then, we come to the famous passage in Matthew 5:17. Do not think that I have come to destroy the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Now, there is a key, two key words here. Kataleo, to abolish in the NIV, and plerao, fulfill in the NIV. But it's not only the law, but it's the law and the prophets, which is said not to be abolished, but to fulfill. And I've already argued that against the background of what Jesus is doing, you might well ask, have you come to start all over again with no reference to the past, or at least only a negative reference to the past of it was all wrong and now I'm going to do it right? No, rather, this is a fulfillment of what is gone, a fulfillment certainly of the law of Moses, but also of the prophets. Now, the question which I want to address is taken up by Bonson in his book concerning the translation and beyond that the meaning of plerao. He suggests the understanding of that word as confirm and offers certain arguments whose details I don't want to get into, although I don't think that's an adequate translation. It's not one of the meanings that are listed as the main meanings in Bauer and Gingrich, for instance, whereas fulfill is a meaning that is listed. I think the Bonson got into a certain difficulty because he argued from the contrast here that there's a contrast between something that isn't done, something that is done. The negative side is abolish. So what is the opposite of abolishing the law? It is confirming it. That is, it is maintaining it in place. The difficulty with that argument is, if I may try and go to the root, because there, if you read Bonson's book, you'll see there's more to it than this, but I'm trying to zero in on a main thing. The difficulty with that argument is that there is more than one kind of opposite. There is the opposite of abolishing the law can either be to confirm it, to maintain it, or it can be to advance it. It's the difference between a static view of things versus a dynamic advance. And in fact, there are other words which would generally be used if what you had in mind was simply a static maintenance of the law. Bebaio, to confirm, and histano, to cause to stand. So that this view is not only histano. It is not only has to account for why pleroo was used in an almost unattested sense, though Bonson claims it's attested in some passages in the Septuagint, but also why the ordinary words that should have been used for the idea of maintenance or confirmation were not used. To see that this in another way, let me ask rhetorically, whether the Mosaic revelation was a confirmation and a maintenance of the covenant with Abraham. Was it an abolition of the covenant of Abraham? Clearly not. Was it a maintenance? Certainly it was. But was it only that, you see? And I think you've got to say that in some respects it was an advance. There was an additional revelation of the name of God in Exodus 3, and there were, you know, a spelling out of the obligations of the covenant in a much richer way. There's an enrichment. You may say that all of redemptive history is a confirmation of Genesis 3:15, the seed of the serpent passage. But is it just a confirmation of it? Isn't it also an enrichment of it? Isn't it a bringing of it to its full expression? And if I may zero in on this but, I've not come to abolish but to fulfill. Again, that can be two kinds of contrast. Lead us not into evil, into temptation, but what's the opposite of lead us into temptation? Leave us where we are. Deliver us from evil is, see, a static advance. A dynamic advance as opposed to just leaving us where we are. So I'm saying, look, that isn't the only way of construing it. In fact, in view of the natural meaning of pleroo and the possibility of using other words, it's got to be, and the context of Matthew, it's got to be seen as a dynamic advance. So Christ has come to fulfill, to bring to full expression the law, and to bring to fulfillment the promises that are embodied directly in prophecy and hinted at in the law in its symbolic institutions. That at least. Now, the other phrase which I want you to look at in this passage is the time limit phrases, until heaven and earth disappear. And further on, until everything is accomplished. In Greek, the latter phrase, panta genetai, literally, until all things take place or happen. Now, what is that all things? All things for all of history leading up into the consummation and even beyond, because there's a certain respect in which history continues beyond that. Bonson takes it in his book as being virtually synonymous, well, not exactly synonymous, but referring to the same limitation as in verse 18, until heaven and earth disappear. So that the all things is all things until the end of history up to, but not including the consummation. Now, the difficulty with that is you've got to ask, are we saying that the law is then abolished when heaven and earth disappear? Well, you can also take that as a kind of, a rhetorical expression that just means never. But, of course, in Jewish mentality, it's not literally that, because they did believe that the heavens and earth would disappear. So it's not clear to me that that is just a rhetorical statement of saying never. But if not, then all this argument about God's principles of justice are eternally valid and so on has still got to deal, again, with the discontinuities, that apparently there is a discontinuity here, namely the passing away of heaven and earth. Now, Bonson, I think, is comfortable with that in saying, look, there are certain changes in the situation radical changes at the consummation that mean that certain laws are no longer immediately relevant, although if the situation called for it, they would still embody principles of God's justice. That's all fair and good. But still, we need to deal seriously with certain limitations and ask why they're there. Why is this expression about the heavens and earth pass away? Well, it's certainly there in order to impress people with the binding character of the law and its relevance extending even into the New Testament period. But it singles out a transition, an epical transition, a radical break, a situational break with the passing away of the heavens and earth. Now you come to the second expression, until all things are accomplished, and you say, well, does that zero in on the same time period, namely that of the passing away of this heavens and this earth? If it does, why is it there at all? Because it would seem to be unnecessary to be saying the same thing twice and building a sentence, in fact, that becomes a little rhetorically awkward because it has that, the two times it has that limitation, which is, in fact, talking twice about the same thing. Well, I think more weighty than that consideration is the consideration of what is the all. If the all is not literally everything that ever happened, including into the consummation, then it's something like all things that are relevant. Relevant to what? Relevant to, obviously, the fulfillment of the law. In other words, the law is not to be abolished until all things related to its fulfillment are accomplished. And even there, at that point, it is not abolished, but rather changes into its fulfilled form. But the context, the relevant, I think, qualification to the all is, it's all things concerning the achieving of the fulfillment of the law. And what are all those things, according to the Gospel of Matthew? Well, go back to Matthew 4, rather Matthew 3, verse 15. Jesus replied, "Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this, to fulfill," same word, praero, "all righteousness." Jesus sees himself as bringing fulfillment and as fulfilling all righteousness in terms of the events which are being set in motion by John the Baptist, and by Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist. In the context of Matthew, the fulfillment centers in the death and resurrection of Christ. So it is my guess, and I admit nobody can nail things down and say that we're absolutely sure about this, but it is my guess that these two qualifying phrases, the "until," focus on two distinct points in history, namely the passing of the way of heavens and earth at the second coming, if you're an all-mill at least, and the death and resurrection of Christ. That is the all things relating to the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. But then we can ask, well, does the death and resurrection of Christ then result in an abolition of the law? And I think you've got to answer, no, it results in its fulfillment. But you see, Matthew is coloring things, I think, a little bit differently than he sometimes read, as if he were just stressing the continuity and saying the law is the law is the law and is always the same in every respect. No, he's saying things are happening. Things are coming to a head. Things are coming to a realization of what was foreshadowed in the Old Testament, not only in the prophets, but in the law itself. So I take it then that Matthew is in fact harmonizable with the rest of the New Testament, which is seeing both discontinuity and continuity, which we have to assess out of that central point of the death and resurrection of Christ. Now let me mention a little bit about penal sanctions in Matthew, and then finally the process of establishing justice. there is material in Matthew that touches on the area of penology. In fact, it comes right after this passage. One note after another that talks about penalties. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. That's talking about penalties. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, but anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. That's judgment. That's recompense. That's penology. So we need to reckon with what Matthew is doing in this particular area. And in particular, with verse 38, I'm skipping over the passage about adultery and about oaths, which again you will find do interact with penalties. But verse 38 is very interesting, Matthew 5:38. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. Now that is the very passage, one of the articulations of this principle of balancing that we've been talking about. As you have done, it shall be done for you. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, and so on. Now, it is customary to say, not only the theonomists, but lots of other Reformed people, to say, Jesus is here taking his stand against Pharisaic perversion of the law. For one thing, that this passage in the Old Testament, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, which was intended to be an instruction to magistrates, to people in authority concerning the proper penalty structure, this passage is used as an excuse for taking vengeance into your own hands for personal purposes. And secondly, that the Pharisees, of course, were generally perverting the law into a legalism. Now, all that, I think, is true, but by itself, and I do think that Jesus is addressing those problems, but by itself, it does not seem to me to fully deal with every aspect of what is going on here. The reason partly being that Jesus claims not simply to statically maintain the law, not simply to say what Moses says, but to bring it to full expression, if you will, to bring it to fulfillment. And he brings out things of which you can see some of the principles in the Old Testament itself. And I think people are wrong when they then say, well, the Old Testament represents some primitive sub-Christian stage of ethics, and then Jesus takes a stand over against that. Because you can already see that Old Testament religion is a religion of heart and a religion of loving your neighbor and so on. So that those basic principles are already there in the Old Testament, and yet no one has zeroed in on the essence of the matter with quite the force and explicitness that Jesus has done here. That's point one. But I think an even more important point is when you see what Jesus does with this passage, he doesn't simply say, ignore it. Or to say, the trouble is you've applied in a personal sphere a passage which was relevant only to the magistrates. Rather, he does apply that very principle in the next passages. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. There is a kind of balancing process, although it's in a paradoxical form. In terms of the Old Testament penalty structure, I'm not talking about personal vengeance now, myself, but about what happened with the magistrates. If you were struck on the cheek, the proper penalty is that you strike the other fellow back on the cheek, on his cheek, as part of the balancing process. Well, instead of that, you do it, I mean, it's the doubling kind of thing, you see, but now it's doubled in the same direction somehow, right? Struck you on one cheek, then do it again, all right, except on the other cheek. Makes you go 1 mile, then go a second mile, that principle of balancing is still somehow expressed there, but it's expressed turned around. It's expressed paradoxically. So it's not as if Jesus' advice has no connection with that Old Testament statute. He's working off of that old, very Old Testament statute. So you can't say he's just dealing with a perverse understanding of that statute, but he's also dealing with the proper understanding of it and the proper relevance of it to an aspect of personal ethics. The other thing I want to say is I think it's a little bit too simplistic, although it's very complicated to get an alternative to this. It's a little too simplistic to say that the Sermon on the Mount is simply addressing the individual and not the community, because Jesus has started out with his blessings announced in the company of the disciples who have formed a new Israel. This is the Mount Sinai instruction for the new Israel as community, I would argue, as well as individual. And verse 13 through 16 speak in terms which imply corporate as well as individual work. You are the light of the world, individually, but also corporately. So the context, as I see it, is not something you can say, well, it's just personal ethics and doesn't apply on any kind of corporate level. Now, that doesn't solve all the questions about what are the state's obligations, what is the church's obligation as a community, and we'll come to that in a bit. Well, what I want you to see here is that Jesus is actually picking up on a principle of balancing and retribution that is expressed in the Old Testament. And people say with respect to verse 43, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. And they say, well, love your neighbor is there in the Old Testament, but the hate your enemies part is not. Well, it's not there in those terms, but there are things that approach that when you deal with the harem warfare and with David's enemies. So even though it was a perversion, I think, to use that kind of language in order to justify personal hatred, yet I want to ask, is there also an advance here because of a difference in situation? What is that difference of situation? And there's what I want to talk about. Not only the principles of ethics, which I see as articulated here for the kingdom of God, for a new era that's dawning, but also the way in which justice is established. Remember, this is a C then, remember that I formulated in the Old Testament time observing that the establishment of the rule of God's justice over a geographical area or over a people had to be accomplished in a just way, because all God's acts are just and the actions of his people have to be just. They have to conform to those standards of justice. That's just the point the theonomists are making, that nothing is immune from those standards. And that the establishment of the rule of God over the area of the land of Canaan took place by means of harem warfare, and that its maintenance was also by harem warfare. Now, how does Jesus propose to establish the rule of the kingdom of God in the eschatological sense? All right, this is fulfillment then, the kingdom of God. That's the language of the rule of God now in an eschatological form. How does Jesus propose to establish that justice over a people and over a territory? Well, there's some answers in the next section of Matthew, beginning with chapter 8, but I think the clearest and most well-worked-out answer, of course, is in Matthew 28, verse 16 and following. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. All right, so now we have a program of conquest that is not over the territory of the land of Canaan, but over all the earth. And its foundation is the authority that Christ has been given. So the land belongs to you. Go out now. Therefore, go. All right, just like Joshua. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. Now that is the establishment of justice, right? Everything I have commanded you, including the Sermon on the Mount. and surely I will be with you always to the very end of the age. Marching orders issued by the commander of the host, the heavenly host, the army of the Lord, just as Joshua was issued orders, those are our marching orders. Name, it's a conquest by baptism, which, if I can bring in Pauline categories, well, even without the Pauline categories, it's baptism in the name of Christ, the crucified and resurrected Christ, and in the authority of Christ. That is, it's baptism in union with Christ, and now the Pauline category is, it's baptism into his death. It's harem warfare. All right, we go out and kill people, put them to death, put to death the sinful nature. But we don't just leave them dead, right? Because it's the resurrected Christ, and it's the name of this resurrected Christ and of the power of Christ that brings them to spiritual life. Now, that's the difference between Matthew and Joshua, all right? The difference is that Christ was raised from the dead. That therefore, this harem warfare, after you've killed off all the Canaanites, then you bring them all back to life, if I may put it that way. Not that you do it, but that it is done because Christ is your warrior, is your leader, and he has the power to bring them to life. Now, it's precisely that, I would argue, that makes the difference in the penal structure, a difference that's already been perceived back there in the Sermon on the Mount. There was a sense in which the Israelites going into the land of Canaan were simply to hate their enemies. They were to kill them. Because they were the enemies of God too. Okay? And we are to hate our enemies too, in the sense that we hate, of course, the sinful nature, but the hatred and the death is not the end because Christ has been raised from the dead. And so it is a transforming power of Christ that is capable of bringing people to spiritual life, which transforms the character of our attitudes towards those enemies. Well, it's the spiritual hosts of wickedness, first of all, but it's undeniable that non-Christians are under the power of the evil one, that they are spiritual enemies in a certain respect, though they're slaves of a greater enemy, who is Satan, and we free them from that bondage, but we free them by killing them spiritually, by uniting them with Christ in his baptism and placing the name of Christ on them in baptism. Now, it seems to me that that is what makes the difference. And then if you ask about the way in which the harem warfare carries on, particularly with respect to the penology, the balancing of who is profaned, then my answer would be that it is, again, as it was in the Old Testament, it is God who is insulted, of course, by any sin against him. But in the case of blasphemy, in the case of false worship, if that blasphemy or false worship takes place in the midst of the holy community, it is the holy community that is profaned by it, right? And the holy community, then, must deal with that, and must in turn, all right, as you have done, it shall be done to you. All right, let's apply that principle. So you say, so-and-so has blasphemed God in the midst of the holy community of the church. He has profaned that community. What is done in reverse? All right, he is in turn profaned. That is, he is cast out of the community. And to be cast out of the community is to go back into the realm of spiritual death. In other words, you put him to death spiritually, even by that act of excommunication. But there's a second level. You know, it's got to be doubled because it's been done to him, but then you've got to restore the profanation of the community. Now, in the Old Testament, you do it by offering the offending party or the town as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. That profanes, that puts to death the town, right? But it's also, as a whole burnt offering, it is a sacrifice to God through which the people who are offering the offering are then brought back into a state of purity, okay? So the church has to be brought back into a state of purity. How do you do that? Do you put the man to death then and make him a whole burnt offering, or is it really the whole burnt offering of Christ himself offered once and for all? I'd say it's that. Because it is the resurrected power of Christ that dwells in the church. And it's by virtue of that resurrection power that the church continually possesses a purity which is from God, and a purity which was not there in Israel, you see, because Christ had not been raised. There's a transition. And it makes a big difference then. So we say, can the holy community, the community that bears the name of Christ and that must operate in terms of the marching orders of the Sermon on the Mount that says, when you struck on the cheek, then you offer the other as well, that symbolizes that power of the resurrection to purify without the kind of balance you had in the Old Testament? Are we going to say that that community is going to undertake to carry out the death penalty on blasphemers? And I think the answer is obviously no, that the resurrection of Christ makes a difference. Now, you may think by now that the argument is over, and I just became aware during the course of this year it still isn't over, because a theonomist whom I was in discussion with brought forward another argument, and it goes like this, that he was able to agree with virtually everything I'd done up to this point. And then he says, that's all true, but the state, the modern state, if it becomes, what shall I say, if it professes its allegiance to Christ, if it becomes a Christianized state, then it also is offended and profaned by the act of a blasphemer that is in the territory controlled by that state. The reason being that that act is virtually an act of treason against the state. And since the person has tried to destroy the state in return destroys the person. So you get the death penalty by the state. Now, that is a... that is an argument which I didn't anticipate. And I've got several things. I've got a whole bunch of conclusions to pass out, and I might as well refer to part of them as I go through this last part. I've got several aspects of a reply to that proposal, although I think really it does represent an advance in my mind if theonomists can come to see that there is a more going on here in these particular penalties than has customarily been admitted. But I still am not convinced that it's as simple as that with respect to the modern state, and there are several reasons. And one is that if you appeal directly to the passage in Deuteronomy 13, which this particular person didn't, by the way, but if you appeal directly to Deuteronomy 13, you say Deuteronomy 13 justifies the church excommunication, but also justifies the state acting because the state has been profaned and so on, then one of my qualms is that you seem to be changing the rules for holy war in the middle of the stream. That is, it's the argument from Matthew 28 is, we've started out, we've got marching orders from Jesus which define the character of our holy war. And it's clear that in the early days of the church, that holy war was concentrated in just the area that I've described. But now, midway through, apparently, you're going to bring in the state, change the character of the state, make it a holy institution, and then begin executing the statutes of holy war as applied to the area of the state as well. And I'd say, you know, is that really changing the way you're doing holy war? And what grounds do we have if our marching orders during this age are those of Matthew 28? So that's one of my problems. But this particular person, as I was mentioning, doesn't want to appeal, I think, directly to Deuteronomy 13, but to appeal to principles of general equity. To say, basically, there is a general principle of balancing, which I've tried to work out myself. And it's that general principle, in the sense that the state has been sinned against here, that makes me think, I'm putting his words in my mouth, that makes someone think that the state should have the death penalty for blasphemers. And my attitude toward that is to say, look, if that is the way you're going to go, you're back out with all the other Reformed Christians. You don't have anything special as a theonomist, no special insight, because you're just saying my sense of justice is this, is derived from the Bible, and all the rest of us are saying my sense of justice is so, such and such, derived from the Bible. In other words, we haven't got any passages any longer to throw at one another and say this passage requires such and such, because the passages are all gone. The passages have been interpreted another way. They've been interpreted with respect to this holy war idea. So you're out in the same area as everybody else, and so cool it. All right. Not that this particular person was hot, but I'm saying, look, the some of the claims to have all the solutions and have all the answers have just got to disappear. We've got to realize that we've got to be more cautious about, if it's a matter of general equity, that we've understood that general equity rightly. But now let me refer, if I may have one of these passages, papers myself, let me refer to the page 2, because the points are summarized there. The additional difficulty I see, and I'm waiting for an answer to this, because I anticipate that theonomists may find a way of reconciling it in their own minds, but I see a kind of dilemma here. If you say, again, this would be in a post-millennial situation, where the United States or some other nation has become, you know, 90%, 80% Christian, and we begin changing the laws, okay, and then dedicate the state to Christ and write it into the Constitution, maybe, and I'm not saying that that's the right thing to do, I'm not sure, although I think the state owes all its authority to God. Anyway, you kind of consecrate the state to Christ. But the dilemma is this. If the state is holy in a special sense, point 4, all right, if you're able to make the state holy, it would appear that it also participates in the resurrection power of Christ in such a way that its holiness is restored without the necessity of the whole burnt offering. In other words, that would still appear that it's a mistake to invoke the death penalty for blasphemy. If the state is not holy in a special sense, okay, it's unclear how this particular set of sacral crimes, like witchcraft, blasphemy, false worship, and so on, is a unique offense against the state. The state owes all its power to God, the true God, in fact. And in some distant sense, then, any sin against God is also an offense against the God who gives the state its power, and so indirectly would seem to be an offense against the state. But that's so indirect a sense, it seems to me it doesn't justify singling out a particular set of crimes. Any sin is in that category. So it's unclear to me why this particular set of things, like blasphemy, false worship, and so on, is a unique threat to the very existence of the state. So that's about the existing state of the argument as I've been carrying on my dialogue with theonomists. But I want, in the few minutes that are left, partly to go through these conclusions, and I wrote them up just this morning in hopes of that you'd have something to hang on to what I see as the important points that I've tried to make and the important points that we can learn from the two sides on this conflict. A, that the best representatives of theonomy and intrusion, that is the Kleinian position, must be respected for many insights. Don't write these people off. Don't despise them. B, some followers of these positions easily fall into one-sided oversimplification because of the way in which the position frames the questions so as to emphasize continuity or discontinuity respectively. So there are followers of theonomy who will see a statute and bam, get it applied right now without really thinking through its significance in its Old Testament context. And there are followers of intrusion who will see a statute and say, no, not relevant. Throw it out. In other words, you can't learn from it. They're followers, all right? I think Klein and Bonson are both better than that. C are certain lessons from Deuteronomy 13 and the area of false worship, and we've been through that, so I'm not going to go over it, but attempted to summarize things about that. D is there is a complexity that I hope you become aware of as we work through that, and that that means we must do our homework. That is, we must really try to understand the Old Testament and its richness and depth. And it's tremendously exciting, as I got into this, to see the wisdom and beauty of the Old Testament and its laws. But so I would encourage you in that area. And I think, if anything, this conflict, if it's motivated us to appreciate that we need to work on the Old Testament and understanding it, then well and good. E, in the area of penology, I would stress the fact that you can learn from the theonomists that the penalty ought to match the crime. But you can also learn, I hope from what I've said, that you also got to ask, who is the injured party and how may you balance that off? And that's where the rub comes, as I see it, with certain crimes, the sacral crimes, that affect the holiness of the community of faith. And F, in the New Testament period, then, in my opinion, some crimes such as murder, theft, and kidnapping have basically the same structure of injury and redress as they had in the Mosaic period. That is, it's fairly easy to understand who is injured and what is the reciprocal punishment that is due. So, as far as I'm concerned, that is the wise kind of punishment to seek in our modern situation. I know that Christians disagree about that, and I think we ought to be sympathetic there and listen, because, again, there are complexities, but at least as I see it at the moment, there is then a wisdom in the penalties for those crimes. Okay? Well, there's a wisdom in the penalties for all the crimes, but I see the structure of penalty as being basically the same in our age. Now, what I'm saying is that the state, although it has its power from Christ and from God, does not have the power of resurrection in its own hands. All right? It can't raise a murderer to life, a murdered man to life, for instance. All right? And so it must stick with what it can do, which is the area of penalties as articulated in the Mosaic law for things like theft and murder. Other offenses, and this is G, such as blasphemy, false worship, witchcraft, and Sabbath breaking, appear, to me at least, to have a structure of offense and retribution that is related to the fact that the holy community is profaned by acts of allegiance to false gods in its midst. And then in that case, the holy community itself must be the party to bring the punishment. And then is where you invoke, you see, the fact that we bear the name of the resurrected Christ, and that that changes the character of the penal structure. And I think even there, it's a subtle matter, because there are certain respects in which the church in our day is a human institution alongside other human institutions. That it is bound, you know, it organizes itself as a corporation, it owns property, and so on. If somebody is to vandalize a church building, for instance, then that is not a profanation of the name of Christ, right? It's just a profanation of the property that the corporation happens to own. So that seems to me to, give, again, not touch on the uniqueness of the church's stance as a holy community. It touches only on the way in which the church is an institution like all other institutions. So I think there are areas in which the church will not act differently than any other institution. I mean, is still paying attention to general principles of justice, but in which its unique status as holy does not come into view. But there are other instances, and that's particularly the area of false worship in its midst, where these particular considerations come in. And then G was the part that I did, H should be relabeled there, the part that I did just now of saying that now an additional argument is being offered that is more general about the fact that a false worshiper would insult a state which has become explicitly Christian. But defining just what that is, a Christian state, there's several ways of doing it. Is it a state that has written into its statute books laws and penalties that conform to God's standards of justice? Is it a state that has written the name of Christ into its constitution? Is it a state that has been baptized? You know, there's all kinds of ways of talking about that, and that's where my question of is the state really holy in a special sense? And if it isn't, can you apply this kind of consideration to it? Well, I want to leave a little time for questions then in the last few minutes and make sure that I haven't been unclear in some areas. I should have added one other thing. It just comes to mind now. And that is something I've said more than once. You can put it under I or another major point. That the heart of the dispute is not over whether the Old Testament law is binding on us in detail, but how and why and what does it mean, right? Because the Kleinians, in effect, think it's all relevant, but in another way. Solved all the problems. Nobody has any questions. Bob?
I'm just trying to understand, according to Bonson, how a theonomous society would operate. Let's say 80% of the state is Christian.
80% of the population in the state, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think he would say, by legal means, vote in. I mean, don't just have the army take over and impose it, but by legal means, vote in a new constitution or alter the laws with the existing constitution, whatever you need to do to bring in a full set of penalties corresponding to the equity, the general principles of justice articulated in the whole Old Testament. All right, but that's, see, I could say that. All right, it's where the nitty-gritty is, what is that? You know, how general do you have to become in order to really reach principles that are operative here? And I think Bonson's present position, although certain things make me think, I don't know what he'll do with this argument I'm presented. Maybe he'll say, you know, I'm still a theonomist, but I understand these particular statutes in another way, in which case I can say, yeah, I'm a theonomist too, if what we mean is a general sense of the whole Old Testament is giving us revealing God's justice, then everybody ought to be a theonomist. But that's making it so general, it's not what the thing originally stood for, which I think was much more specific. But it at least used to be that Bonson and other people had a view that you would then institute the death penalty for blasphemy and false worship and so on. But that would be protected, for one thing, by saying there has to be evidence that will hold up in court. And it has to be a concrete act. No sins of the mind and so on are not the domain of that the state has a business working with. And they would say, anybody who doesn't like it, who isn't willing to live in this country under those circumstances is welcome to emigrate. People who are willing to live under the circumstances, they're welcome to stay, even if they do not profess the name of Christ themselves. So I imagine that what they're saying is humanists would not ever be executed under this statute because you can't prove they're worshiping anything in a way that will hold up in court, with that kind of obvious. There's a sense, all the theonomists and everybody else is saying, yeah, they're worshiping man, but that, I don't think they would say that that's within the scope of this particular principle. So there's many respects in which I think a Christian could live very comfortably in a theonomic state, provided some of the harshness of spirit that has characterized certain of the theonomists, not all of them, but provided that didn't come in as well, right? But and you see, I think part of the superficial reaction to theonomy has been, that it's absurd, but But something like it did work in the Mosaic periods. And you know, they'll come back and say, do you really believe that the Mosaic laws were just and embodied the justice of God? And if you don't, then you're quarreling with God and with Moses and not with us. But you see, I would agree with them on that, you see, and then say, but the real question is, you know, understanding what those laws are doing. And if they're doing what I think they're doing, the ones related to these sacral crimes, then it's a big mistake to just carry them directly over. Carl.
You think in his work that Bonson deals adequately with what perhaps he would say is the continuity, or maybe the discontinuity between the theocratic argument that we commonly use, where we no longer live in a theocratic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I feel as if there's still a lot of validity to that argument, and he slithers away from it.
Yeah, well, that is a tricky one. You have noticed I have not dealt with that directly, the argument we're not a theocracy, but defining what is a theocracy is a little bit tricky, because there's a sense in which any state owes its all of its authority to God, and there's, of course, we do want, as a reform person, I think that what we ought to be working for is laws that conform to Christian standards of justice. There are unique features to Israel, and Bonson is not unaware of them, but he'll use this argument to the effect, even in its uniqueness, Israel is exemplary of what all the nations should be, you see. And that's where it gets tricky. There, you know, the priests are involved as the people go out for holy war. The priests say, the Lord your God is fighting with you. But there are ways in which the theonomists see that. They see that element as capable of being removed or dealt with by analogy, and I think they don't feel the same way about that kind of element. In other words, they'll say, well, in our day, there's no holy war, but there can be a just war, and there might be fitting that the pastors and church leaders would, if you know, they thought it was a just war, would go and exhort the army and that kind of thing. So they would draw a vague parallel, even though they would admit the special character. I hope they would admit the special character of that holy war as not equivalent to our just war. So that they would be willing to work with those vague parallels. Whereas the Kleinians, for them, the uniqueness stands out so much that they're horrified with the idea of using that as a parallel. But see, I think it goes both ways in the sense of saying that there is uniqueness to Israel, and that uniqueness and the typology penetrates all the way through. I mean, there's no bit that is somehow isolated from that. It penetrates, for instance, to the penalties for theft, because that balancing principle is a principle that you see carried out in the penology of the crucifixion. But the penalties for theft are still relevant to the state today, as I argue, or the penalties for murder. So once you say there's all that uniqueness that affects every detail, then you've said the Kleinian part, but then you can also say precisely in that uniqueness there are available general principles that God is revealing himself and who he is and what his justice is like, so that you can learn. I've heard Klein say something similar to that, although he's, you know, always laying all kinds of barriers in way of a direct carrying over. So it's, yeah, that's why I haven't appealed to that argument alone. Well, you're dismissed.